In 1951, 4 years after independence, Ambedkar resigned from the cabinet because there was a law minister. He'd been working on the reform of Hindu law. He'd met with fierce opposition from caste Hindus, even those within the government itself, and he wasn't able to complete his work. So he resigned. And it was around this time that I myself came in personal contact with him. First of all through correspondence, and then we had several meetings. At the end of 1954, he announced that he would devote the remainder of his life to the propagation of Buddhism in India. He'd been a serious student of Buddhism for some time. His first contact with Buddhism was when he was 16, when he was presented with the Marathi translation of Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia, that same Light of Asia that had figured so prominently in the life of Anagarika Dharmapala. And in the course of years, he'd gradually become convinced that Buddhism was the best religion for him and for his followers. He liked it because, in his view, it did not conflict with reason. It did not condone the caste system, did not condone man's inhumanity to man, and moreover, it was of Indian origin. It wasn't foreign. No foreign culture came with it. So, in 1956, he did actually become a Buddhist, along with 380,000 of his followers. The ceremony took place in Nagpur in central India, and it took place on the 14th of October. Well, today's the 14th of October, 39 years later, and it's a very auspicious coincidence, I think, that I happen to be giving this lecture on that very day, 39 years later. I assure you it was a coincidence. We didn't plot or plan this, did we? When I accepted the invitation, I had no idea that I'd be speaking on this particular date. But here we are. The conversions in Nagpur sparked off others all over India. It was the greatest event for Buddhism in India for many hundreds of years. Former untouchables felt that they were free. Free from Hinduism. Free from the caste system. They felt that they had been reborn. I remember this very well. When I was moving around amongst them, months and years later, I used to ask them, what difference has becoming Buddhist meant for you? And 9 times out of 10, I'd get this reply. They'd say, now that I'm a Buddhist, I feel free. And that seems to have been the most important thing of all. Socially, psychologically, spiritually, free. That's how they felt. But unfortunately, 6 weeks after the conversion ceremony in Nagpur, Ambedkar died. He died in Delhi on the 6th of December at the age of 64. And his death came as a terrible shock to his followers. I was in Nagpur at the time, and I well remember their reaction. They were afraid that the conversion movement would collapse. But it didn't collapse. I myself worked among these new Buddhists for several years. And for the last 18 years, the Trilokya Bodhimahasangha, the Indian wing of the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, has been carrying on that work amongst them. The significance of Dr. Ambedkar's life and work is exceptionally profound and far-reaching. How to uplift his people? This was the great problem that he faced. How to uplift them socially, economically, educationally, in all respects. And he felt that they could be uplifted only through a change of religion. He felt it wasn't enough just to leave Hinduism, not just enough to give up the caste system. They had to find another, better religion. Because Ambedkar himself a deeply religious man, believed that religion was essential to human life. He believed that man could not really live without religion. So for him there was no question of pursuing, for instance, the communist option. Dr. Rembedek was very critical of communism. He believed that real social and economic revolution was possible only on the basis of a spiritual revolution, and he therefore inaugurated what we now call the Dhamma revolution, which is not just a nominal change of religion, but a transformation of one's whole life in every aspect. Not just individual transformation, but even collective transformation as well. So this is the great movement that Dr. Ambedkar set in motion. He showed, in the midst of the 20th century, that a change of religion could bring about a change for the better in the lives of millions of people, especially when that religion was Buddhism. The conversion of Dr. Ambedkar and his followers to Buddhism is also of profound significance for Buddhism itself. Dr. Ambedkar was well aware that Buddhism had disappeared from India once, and he didn't want it to disappear again, now that it had been revived. But why had it disappeared? One of the principal reasons, he felt, was the separation which had developed between the monks on the one hand, the lay people on the other. The monks lived together in monasteries, and in the course of centuries, those monasteries had become bigger and bigger, housing thousands of monks, whereas the lay people lived at home. The monks were ordained, but there was no ordination for the lay people, so that very often they didn't feel that they were really Buddhists, and therefore they came more and more under Hindu Brahminical influence, especially after the great monasteries were destroyed in the 10th, 11th and 13th centuries by the Muslim invaders. And eventually the lay Buddhists were absorbed back into the Hindu community. Buddhism disappeared from India. Only ruins were left. So what was Ambedkar's solution to this problem? He decided that there had to be an ordination for lay people, corresponding to monastic ordination for monks. And he called this lay ordination Dhamma Diksha. It consisted of two parts. First of all, taking the refuges and five precepts, refuges in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, of course, and the usual five precepts, and then secondly, taking 22 vows. Not only that, Ambedkar took the refuges and five precepts from Uchandramani, a very senior bhikkhu. But then he repeated himself 22 vows which he had drawn up personally, not traditional vows. He devised these vows and he repeated them by himself aloud at that gathering after taking the refuges and precepts from Uchandramani. And he then proceeded to administer refuges, precepts, and vows, 22 vows, to his followers, 380,000 of them. And this was highly significant. Ambedkar was initiated into Buddhism by a monk, but his followers were initiated into Buddhism by Ambedkar, a layman, thus placing the monk and the layman, in a sense, on an equal footing. Both, after all, monk and layman alike, go for refuge. It's going for refuge that makes one a Buddhist, whether monk or lay person. That is secondary. So Ambedkar, in effect, asserted this principle that going for refuge is primary, lifestyle secondary. But what about those 22 vows? As I said, they were drawn up, they were devised by Ambedkar himself. And they had the effect, they had the intention of completely separating the new Buddhists from their old Hindu religion. In the course of those vows, they explicitly renounced Hinduism. They promised to give up the worship of the Hindu gods and goddesses, to whom very often animal sacrifice would be offered. In other words, those vows made it clear that it was not possible to be a Buddhist and a Hindu. In those days, in India, I remember very well, and probably Dr. Bajwanyana remembers, there were quite a lot of people who believed you could be a Buddhist as well as being a Hindu. Buddhism was just something you added on to your Hinduism. You had a big Hindu temple, so to speak, and a little tiny Buddhist annex. I remember a Hindu monk, a Swami, upbraiding me, in fact, after my own ordination as a Buddhist monk, saying, "Why have you become a Buddhist monk and not a Hindu monk?" He said, "Hinduism is like the great ocean. Buddhism is just a little tiny stream." I mean, that was their attitude. So Ambedkar wanted to get it clear. He wanted to make it clear that it wasn't possible to be a Buddhist and a Hindu. I've sometimes thought we need something like Ambedkar's 22 vows here in the West. Because here in the West, some people unfortunately think it's possible to be both a Buddhist and a Christian. But personally, I strongly disagree with this view. And I think it represents a betrayal of Buddhism, a confusion of thought. But it's time we passed on to our last but one great Buddhist of the 20th century,